It's time for the Week in Review. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Each week, we take a look at the top news stories of the week from a couple of different perspectives and yours. If you choose to join us at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or find the Joy Cardine program on Facebook. My two guests this hour, Ed Filone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, John.
And Kevin Hermaning, political activist and certified financial planner, managing partner of Hermaning Financial Group, LLC in Wausau. Kevin, good morning to you.
Well, and good morning.
President Obama said this week that he would not meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow next month due to Russia granting asylum to Edward Snowden. Obama's getting support for the decision from both sides of the political aisle here at home. Ed Filone, do you support the president's decision?
Well, I think he had to cancel the summit. I think the Obama administration views the granting of asylum to Edward Snowden as a unnecessary provocation, and they had to respond, and this was the easiest and most timely way to respond. But I think it also provides an excuse to avoid the summit. It seems at this stage there really isn't a lot on the table. There's not a lot that Russia can give to the United States, and there's not a lot, frankly, the United States can give to Russia. And so we have these bilateral summits without really a lot to talk about. And so I think it's probably for the best to cancel the summit. And it's probably for the best that the Republicans are holding their fire on this and not interjecting themselves into this foreign policy debate.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, of course, there's plenty for Republicans to object to with regard to the president's foreign policy, but if we're going to just narrow the conversation at this moment to the upcoming summit that's now been canceled, I think it was a wise decision. We do have very few overlapping interests any longer with Russia as we know it today. The Russians, of course, are not going to help us in Syria if they consider that Bashar al-Assad is still going to win and remain in power. So there's not going to be any cooperation there. Probably the bigger other issue with regard to the Russians and our foreign policy is what's going on in Iran. And the Iranians have not been all that supported by the Russians lately. The Russians have given the United States its support when it comes to some of the securities resolutions in the United Nations. And so, you know, as Ed said, and I concur with this, there's not a lot in common between the United States and this particular Russia anymore. The interests aren't there, and energy, of course, remains the area of common interest, but I think it was the right decision.
Well, Kevin, let me ask you this, and then I want to hear from Ed Filone on this as well. Is Russia a friend or foe to the United States?
Well, it was clearly a slap in the face when the Russians granted Snowden asylum. In my view, there's much to like about what Snowden was trying to do in his exposure of all of the extreme elements of data gathering and intelligence gathering on the American people by this administration. But he broke the law. He had a security clearance that required certain types of behavior, and he violated that. I would say that the president made his biggest mistake when he put forth his so-called, quote, reset many years ago in his relationship with Russia. We reset, and, of course, the Russians didn't. And so the question today is, what's left of our interest in dealing with this Russia? And the answer is not very much.
Ed Filone, Russia friend or foe?
Well, I don't think it can be defined that way. I mean, I think what we have in Russia today is an oligarchy under Putin, which really is unpredictable. It's hard to know what Putin's objectives are other than maintaining some sort of influence in the world for Russia and obviously advancing the interests of his oligarch class. So they're a bit of a loose cannon, and I think that it is Kevin's right that the real question that's lurking here under the surface is, was the Obama administration's attempt to reset relations with Russia, start with a clean slate, productive or not. You know, there's been this continued reflexive demonizing of Russia from the right wing in our country. That certainly wasn't getting us anywhere under the George W. Bush administration. I think the reset was worth a try, but I think it's also fairly clear at this stage that it was not productive, and it hasn't resulted in anything positive in the relationship. But I'm not sure what would, given the unpredictableness of the Putin administration.
Listen, they are the 14th largest economy in the world, and in a world in which economics matter a great deal, we do have important reasons to be concerned about the behavior of Russia. And all big economies and all big powerful countries with who have military interests, and it's no longer the Cold War, certainly, but they're certainly not our friends.
The U.S. is escalating its drone strikes in Yemen, where Yemeni military officials say 34 suspected al-Qaeda militants have been killed in less than 2 weeks. Three strikes on Thursday alone killed a dozen people. The U.S. and Britain evacuated diplomatic staff from Yemen's capital this week and closed 19 diplomatic posts in the Middle East and Africa after learning of a threatened al-Qaeda attack. Kevin Hermaning, how big a threat does al-Qaeda pose to the U.S. abroad or here at home?
Well, I think al-Qaeda poses a great threat globally to the United States because as any entity which attempts to use terrorism in the, as their main method of extracting concessions and behavioral changes out of people and out of governments, they certainly managed to do that. It's had a tremendous impact on the behavior of this administration, which seems quite cowed by the lack of response to increase and improve security, despite the numerous requests by diplomatic sources back in pre-Benghazi days in Libya, and it seems quite interesting that this administration seems unable to do anything other than use the drones to try to impact and disrupt the terrorists abroad. We've learned, of course, that they're even using drones in the United States, and I'm sure Ed has some concerns about that, not for military purposes at this stage, but it's a great concern. I think there is something for the United States to be worried about, and that is that we've been unable to really have, as the president said, quote, al-Qaeda on the run. They're anything on the run. We're the ones on the run at this stage. It's sad.
Ed Falone, President Obama did say before the election last year that al-Qaeda was on the run. Was he wrong, or do you think they are, in fact, in trouble?
Well, again, we have to watch how we phrase the question here. The question isn't whether al-Qaeda is a threat. Of course it's a threat. The question is the policy of drone strikes working? We tend to be fairly forgiving of foreign policy objectives if they work, and quite critical if they don't work. That seems to be the trend in this country. The drone strikes have been very effective at killing the command and control, the centralized command and control of al-Qaeda. Obviously, Osama bin Laden is dead as well through the military action of the Navy SEALs. So the strategy of the Obama administration to assassinate the centralized control of al-Qaeda has been very effective. However, al-Qaeda is shifting to a decentralized, much more decentralized model even than it was before. And obviously these auxiliary franchises around the world are self-contained units, such as the one in Yemen that's causing a great deal of concern at the moment. And so the drone strikes have not been as effective there. I'm not sure what could be effective there. It's sort of like chasing cockroaches around your kitchen. So I think the question is, have the drone strikes been effective? Are they working? If the public believes they have been effective and they are working in at least reducing the capability of al-Qaeda to do large-scale terrorist attacks, then a lot of the constitutional concerns will be forgiven by the public. On the other hand, if it seems the drone strikes aren't working, that al-Qaeda is still capable of launching large-scale attacks in the U.S. or elsewhere, then I think if it's not working, people will be more concerned about the constitutional questions behind
it. Well, Ed, what about the Al-Qaeda question? Are they a big threat? Are they a threat at all? And if they're a threat, how big a threat would you say they are to the United States? Where on our list of problems does terrorism lie?
Well, terrorism is a fact of modern life. As long as you have modern technology that enables a small group of people to have access to information and technology that can cause bombings, you know, weapons of mass destruction, you're not going to eliminate terrorism. If it only takes a cell of five people to launch a large-scale attack, or two people, the Boston Marathon, you're not going to eliminate terrorism. But what you can do is you can keep them decentralized, not in communication with each other, keep them from linking up and having a broader influence other than isolated killings. And so in that regard, that Al-Qaeda is not a political presence, that it has not become an international body that can make decisions across borders, that's what's been disrupted by the Obama administration, and I think that that's an important success.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. It's the Week in Review for second Friday in August. I'm not even looking at the right calendar. And we're talking with our guests about the top news stories of the week, wondering what you think. 800-642-1234. When we come back, we're going to talk about ticketing protesters at the state capitol and the potential for ticketing people who are just there watching. That was this week's controversy under the dome, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we come back from a break. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're the Week in Review, our look back at the week's news from a couple of different political perspectives. Ed Filone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, is with me, as well as Kevin Hermaning, political activist and certified financial planner, managing partner of Hermaning Financial Group, LLC, in Wausau. Police have arrested more protesters in the Wisconsin Capitol. Protesters have been singing songs against Republican Governor Scott Walker in the Capitol Rotunda almost every noon hour for more than 2 years. Police began a crackdown on them on July 24th for lacking a permit. The protesters maintain they don't need one because they're exercising their right to free speech. They also say the permit requires applicants to assume responsibility for any damage to the building. But since they're not an organized group, no one can officially assume liability. Officers have issued more than 175 tickets over the last 2 weeks, including 18 yesterday. Ed Filone, should these protesters be ticketed?
Well, I think that some of them can be ticketed. I mean, I think the problem here is that from the start, the protest policy put in place in the Capitol was overbroad. It clearly covered protests protected by the Constitution, in addition to large-scale protests that would allow for a permitting process. It required payment in advance for a permit instead of billings after the fact if there was any damage. So it had a lot of constitutional problems in overbreadth and its application. There is a way to have a policy in place that manages the protests in the Capitol, allows them to go forward, but in a way that is a little bit more structured than the current free-for-all. But I don't think that a crackdown like we've seen with the Park Police taking away people in handcuffs for a ticketing violation, for threatening arrest of people in the audience watching the singers, I don't think a crackdown like that is productive here. Democracy is messy. It should be messy. People should have the right to speak out. That's what freedom is about. And we should have a flexible policy for protests in the Capitol that reflects that and not this sort of crackdown that we're currently seeing.
Kevin Hermaning?
So listen, this behavior is something that has gone on way too long, been tolerated way too long by a group of people who are the most disrespectful, intolerant citizens and people who aren't citizens of the state of Wisconsin. I would imagine that if you talked to the average person in these protest groups, that they would describe the governor and his administration as fascist. But the technical term, definition of the term fascist ideology is one that consistently invokes the primacy of the state. Now, these protesters oppose this state government, but I'm pretty sure that they would very much raise up the primacy of their state as they would seek to decide and define it. And so how does Ed and others think that the police are supposed to deal with protesters who won't follow the law and simply paying for a permit or requesting a permit in advance? I didn't even know there was a fee. I don't think there's a fee for it. Clearly, somebody should have to pay, anyone who's responsible for damaging the Capitol, any public property. And what are they so unwilling to share the property with? I read an article this week of a reporter, a former citizen of the state of Wisconsin from New York, who said that she traveled back to show solidarity, and she couldn't quite understand why people were being arrested in this process. And she also claimed that they were exiting the Capitol regularly when permitted groups were trying to show up for their events and activities. And we all know that that isn't true because weddings had been planned and the protesters wouldn't leave, so the weddings had to leave. And so it's an unfair characterization to suggest that the police are being overbearing by a bunch of bullies unwilling to simply share the state resources with all citizens and behave in a tolerant, normal manner. And I'm surprised that there hasn't been true violence by people who are getting sick and tired and fed up with the behavior of the protesters, who obviously have nothing else more productive to do to improve our state and our society and improve the lots of people who are, quite frankly, still looking for jobs and trying to improve education in this state.
Democratic State Representative, hold on.
I mean, I'm still trying to get my head around what Kevin just said.
Don't be a bully, Ed. Don't join the bullies. You're part of the bully group if you support their behavior.
Yeah, well, aside from your characterizing the protests in one fell swoop as a bunch of fascists, let's remember, Kevin, that the birth of the Tea Party movement, so beloved of the current Republican establishment in this state and nationwide, was a bunch of people disrupting town hall forums on health care policy and taking over and disrupting the forum and screaming and yelling. And a lot of people weren't happy about that, Kevin, but that's democracy. And they supported the right of those individuals to speak out. And I think that for you to be very selective in who has the right to speak out and protest and who doesn't is unfortunately reflective of a real blind spot on your part. The Constitution guarantees that right for everyone, Kevin, not just for the groups we agree
with. I just suggested they needed to follow the rules, and I have attended and been a part of and spoken at a number of Tea Party organizations, and in every single case I have seen the permits that were purchased to gather in city parks and in public buildings. So don't tell me there's a comparison between the Tea Party going out and buying, purchasing permits in some cases or receiving them after a proper application and the bullies that are commonly disregarding the other people's rights in the state capitol.
No, the difference is that when you have a...
Have you ever heard of a Tea Party person being arrested, Ed? No.
There's a big difference, Kevin. A public protest or parade in the outside with a large group of people can be permitted under the Constitution, but the Capitol is not the public space. The Capitol is a public space. It's not equivalent to a public park. It is a public space where protests have occurred for a very long time. It is considered a public forum under the Constitution, and greater free speech rights under the First Amendment take place in the state capitol than in a park across the street. That's simple constitutional doctrine, and any lawyer could tell you that and explain that to you. And unfortunately, what we have here is an attempt by the Walker administration to impose policies without regard to longstanding First Amendment doctrine, without caring about First Amendment doctrine, and that's where they're overreaching, Kevin.
Democratic State Representative Sandy Pope of Middleton says she was threatened with arrest this week for simply being an observer at the noontime sing-along. Kevin, is that going a little too far?
Anybody who is not purchasing or receiving a permit to continually violate the law or the administrative rules in the state capitol should receive the same treatment, whether they're an elected official or not. She has a responsibility to follow the rules that have been put down. I don't know why, you know, it apparently is so onerous on the part of liberals and progressives to ask for a permit, just like it's so onerous for people to ask for or receive to pay for if they can or are required to, or if they can't afford to have and request for free an ID to go and vote. The hypocrisy of the people on the left never ceases to amaze me.
So hang on. So if you happen to be in the Capitol when this this protest is occurring and you're just watching it, then you should get a permit for that? Is that what you're suggesting? I just want to be clear.
What I'm telling you is that she actually became part of the Solidarity sing-along, despite the fact that she wasn't singing, she was still part of the group, and we know that from the video that's been released. So yes, if she's part of it, just because she wasn't opening her mouth, she was still part of the protest that was going on. She wasn't simply observing up from the second deck, uninvolved and disinterested.
Ed Falone?
Well, this is really what's the fundamental concern here. People have a First Amendment right. The Supreme Court has been very clear that permits cannot be required for small groups. Initially, this policy that was proposed by the Walker administration applied to groups as small as four people. It's very clear under Supreme Court precedent, established constitutional doctrine, you cannot require a group of four people, a group that small, to get a permit in advance. There's absolutely no justification for it. The justification for a permit is to allow for security and to allow for, the minimization of disruption. A peaceful protest, and of course, you know, none of this applies to people throwing bricks, but a peaceful protest of four people does not raise security concerns, does not cause a disruption. The Supreme Court has been very clear on this. So what we have here is an attempt to blur the issues and say, oh, you have to follow the rules. Well, you know, you don't have to follow unconstitutional rules. That's why we have a constitution. We could pass a rule requiring all handgun owners to turn in their handguns, and Kevin would scream and yell about the Second Amendment doesn't allow you to pass that rule. Same thing applies when you try and take away someone's free speech rights. You can't do it. The Constitution doesn't allow it, and the Walker administration should stop trying to do it.
All right, let's move on. Governor Walker says he believes there would be significant bipartisan support in the legislature to create a mandatory minimum sentence for those who illegally possess a gun. Walker says such a measure also has his support. The governor commented after a news conference by Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and Police Chief Edward Flynn. They called for the minimum sentence and asked the state to provide $500,000 in matching funds to help pay police overtime to stem recent gun violence in Milwaukee. You're in Milwaukee, Ed Falone. What do you make of Barrett and Flynn's call, and should state government pay for municipal police?
Well, I think so. I think obviously Milwaukee is the largest urban center in the state. It has problems with crime that other parts of the state don't have. And so I think Milwaukee should get special attention in helping it to deal with these problems, which, quite frankly, affect all urban areas. I think that we have a gun culture right now, which is part of our problem. And we just have to do something about changing the culture where guns are easily accessible, easily purchased, too many people have firearms on the streets, and in an urban area, especially in the summertime when people are out on the streets at all hours late into the night, that's a recipe for trouble.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, no doubt Ed would be on the front lines of opposing any kind of curfew in the most dangerous neighborhoods. So don't even bring up the idea of people on the streets till all hours of the night. Clearly, it is clear to me that the majority of the people who are, quote, on the streets till all hours of the night are not at home with their children. They're not raising the families that in many cases they've helped to create, and they're certainly not participating in the job market. So we could go down this path in so many different ways. The city of Milwaukee is the biggest beneficiary of the transfer of state dollars from taxpayers all across the state. And just because Mayor Barrett and the police chief choose to not use it in the best manner and keep their city and the citizens and the residents safe, isn't the state's, the rest of the residents' problem. Our responsibility, those of us out in the hinterlands of Wisconsin, in Wausau and Sheboygan and Ashland and everywhere else, we have a responsibility to put money into the state coffers. The state legislature and the governor have a responsibility to direct those dollars into the communities and leave the decisions up to the local elected officials. Clearly, there is a failure among the local elected officials and senior law enforcement officials who are clearly not taking care of their citizens and keeping them safe.
Well, that's sort of the strategy, isn't it, Kevin? Let's have the state turn its back on Milwaukee.
I just said Milwaukee receives more money than any other area in the state.
Yeah, and we've seen the tax flow be reduced to Milwaukee. We've seen even such things as the ability of Milwaukee to raise taxes off of billboards reduced. And so the strategy is leave Milwaukee to its own devices with a tax base that's shrinking, large-scale unemployment. And then when the inevitable difficulties arise, let's blame the leadership and use it to attack the Democratic leadership of the city. So we are one state. We're one state, and the problems of Milwaukee are the problems of the whole state. And I think the Walker administration needs to recognize that we're one state. And I think the governor, in this case, with the gun violence, at least has been open to some criminal law amendments, which would be useful, and which the mayor and the chief of police in Milwaukee have called for. I think that that's a positive thing. But I also think that resources are important, and that you need to give the city and the city leaders the tools they need to address their very real problems.
Governor Walker says he has ordered top officials in his administration to study ways to avoid another situation like the one that led to euthanizing a fawn from a no-kill shelter. The fawn, named Giggles, was brought to the St. Francis Society shelter near the state line by an Illinois family who believed the animal had lost its mother. But State Department of Natural Resources officials took the animal from the shelter and euthanized it, saying state law required it to prevent the spread of disease. Walker said Monday that he had asked members of his cabinet earlier in the day to discuss the issue and present him with options. Walker said, "I don't ever want to see something like that again." Kevin Hermaning, your assessment of what happened here, who's in the right, who's in the wrong, and how should this have been handled?
Well, I think the state DNR officials did the thing they needed to do under the current rules and the law, and they are concerned about how diseases could have been spread, and legitimately concerned about how disease could have been spread in not only the wild population, but also among animals who might have become or come in contact with this particular animal. And if the governor feels that he would like to see some type of a change in the law, it's a responsibility, he has a responsibility to ask his leadership team to present him with options, which you just indicated he's done. And, you know, stories like this that involve Bambi, cute animals like this, always get the most attention. These extreme types of cases, you don't make good policy decisions when you personalize it and you deal with a particular individualized situation like this.
Ed Filone?
Well, I mean, I want to demonstrate my good faith here. Kevin hit the nail right on the head. This is a perfect summer news story. Giggles the fawn. I certainly don't want anyone to think that I don't like animals. I love animals. But it's hard to see why the governor's cabinet should be spending any time on this. It's not something that calls out for legislative reform.
All right.
I think they were looking ahead to the election of next year, and all these terrible commercials, similar to the stories we heard during last year's presidential campaign about Governor Mitt Romney and his dog on the roof of his car in the little cage.
So how should we avoid something like this happening in the future? Kevin, do we have to change the law, or would it be possible for the DNR to make a phone call first and find out what's really going on before showing up in force?
Well, the law mandates that I am the first person to tell you that I have no knowledge of what led to the creation of this type of a law, other than what I can only imagine was a public safety or a nuisance issue however many decades ago, and maybe only a couple days or years ago, that it became law. I'm not familiar with the law. But I think Ed is right. It's a great summer story, and if only we would have reporters that would engage in the type of reporting with regard to the failure of the of our economy and the failure of our schools and all the other problems we have. Reporters, obviously, in this case, needed a lot more to report on.
I think that the message here for all our listeners is, if you see a wild animal in distress, you know, call the authorities before you do anything. If you see a wild animal that's not in distress, and I think Giggles was simply a young fawn on her own, as to the best of my knowledge, leave it alone. Just leave wild animals alone. It is not.
Yeah, I mean, who does that, right, Ed? Who goes out there and picks up a fawn? I mean, it never would occur to me to do that.
Well-meaning people often think that they're rescuing wild animals, when in actuality, they're you know, the parent may be nearby and the human doesn't see the parent, or you know, the human being just misunderstands the situation, or the animal would be fine if left to their own devices, or you're just, you know, delaying the inevitable if you have a wild animal in distress that's going to die anyway. So I think that the lesson here is if you have an animal that's obviously in distress, a wild animal, call the authorities, ask what to do. If it's not obviously in distress, leave it alone and move on.
And we've got actually somebody with a call who could maybe clarify some of the issues here that were really upsetting people. Let's go to David in New Richmond. David, good morning.
I think you made good points there about leaving the animal alone, but the thing that upset me was the number of law enforcement people that they decided that they needed to show up at that facility. You know, around here in St. Croix County, our local warden would have handled that by himself. They sent, like, a handful of deputies to take care of one animal. I just wonder who's making the decisions to spend the money on these public officials' salaries that they don't have anything better to do. That's my question.
Kevin, and then Ed, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, well, I don't know what to say other than to agree with the caller.
All right, Ed, what about you?
Well, yeah, I think that, I agree with the caller.
I'm a little tired of the story, too, by now.
All right, we'll move on. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have the Week in Review quiz. I guarantee it's not about baby deer. So let's do that. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Week in Review. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back next week. And joining me this morning, Ed Filone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Kevin Hermaning, political activist and certified financial planner, managing partner of Hermaning Financial Group, LLC, in Wausau. We'll get back to more issues in the news in just a moment, but first, our Week in Review quiz. It was a monumental week for the food industry. Scientists in London served up the world's first lab-grown what? What was it? Scientists in London served up the first, the world's first lab-grown fill-in-the-blank. What was it? You can call us at 800-642-1234 and submit your answers to the Week in Review quiz, and we'll reveal the answer to this week's quiz and our winner just before the end of the hour. Okay. Meanwhile, back in the news, Madison State Representative Brett Halsey said Tuesday he's considering a run for governor. But critics said the declaration was just the latest example of his recent bizarre behavior. Also fueling the oddball perception, a recent campaign finance report showing Halsey had spent about $1,200 on an old red convertible and $85.39 on a triathlon in Lake Mills. What's going on with Brett Halsey? Ed Filone.
Well, first of all, let me just say I was just recently a candidate for office, and I didn't know you could get a convertible out of that. I don't think it's really productive to characterize people and throw around labels like oddball, whether you're on the left or the right. I don't think that that's very helpful. I think the only question here is whether Brett Halsey is serious about maybe running for governor or not. And
let me rephrase the question. Would he be a viable candidate?
No, he has no money. He has no money. He admits he doesn't even have enough personal funds to repair his regular car, which is why he had to buy this convertible. I think he listed raising about $4,000 his last campaign. And to go up against Governor Walker, you're going to need to raise millions of dollars or be able to self-fund to the tune of millions of dollars. There's no way Brett Halsey can do that. He's not going to be a candidate, and if he did declare, he wouldn't be a viable candidate.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, I'm not going to get into characterizing individuals by calling them names in this discussion, this part of the discussion of this morning. Though we should say that Halsey himself is the one who called one of the other prospective candidates, Mary Burke, the Madison School Board member, a turnip, or having the personality of a turnip. So I think that it wouldn't be uncharacteristically, or it wouldn't be terrible to use certain types of definitions like, or words like oddball. Remember, this is the same guy who was cited for, quote, horseplay, as the news stories report, with children at a Madison beach last year. There's a lot of weird stuff out there. The mayor of Madison had to ask him to apologize for his behavior and his antics. If all the candidates are this strong, I'm not sure the governor is going to have to raise much money at all to be reelected.
Well, let's ask the next question then is, who's in the best position to challenge Governor Walker next year? Ed, do the Democrats have anybody? Doesn't seem like they're exactly lining up for the chance.
No, I think it's for those of us who lean towards the left, it certainly is concerning that you don't see some strong candidates stepping forward. I mean, it's a very divided state. I think that it's a state that the Democrats could win. There still remains substantial opposition to many of Governor Walker's policies, but I think it's really the money that has driven off some very strong candidates who sort of circled around, looked around, and so far have decided not to jump in. And I think that's one of the problems in our democracy is that you do have good candidates, people who would make a positive change in our society, but because they don't have access to funding or they're worried about their access to funding, they don't get in the race. And I think that it's always bad when good candidates don't run.
Well, Ed, what about you? Would you think about running?
Well, I don't know if this is exactly going to be a scoop, but I can declare that I will not be a candidate for governor.
Okay, you heard it here first. Kevin Hermaning, is there anybody out there on the Democratic side you think that Governor Walker ought to be looking out for?
Well, I'm going to join in and tell people that I will not be a Democratic candidate for governor next year either.
Well, there's another news bulletin. There's another news bulletin.
So, you know, one thing that we could consider is the idea that considering that we've actually had two statewide elections for the position of governor over the last 3 years, I don't think it's really a big surprise that the majority of the voters in the state of Wisconsin approve of this governor's policies. And I think if the election were held today, just like I think it'll when it happens next November of 2014, that the governor is going to be reelected overwhelmingly, he would right now. I mean, there is so much popular support. The state of Wisconsin is now in the top 10 as far as jobs being created in the country. Things are moving in the right direction. I don't know if we're going to get to that quarter million job target that the governor candidate Walker said he would try to attain in his first 4 years. But it's kind of interesting that no one seems to be lining up in an effort to make a serious campaign run against this governor. Clearly, they must be reading the tea leaves like I am and realize that he's a pretty popular guy right now, with good reason.
Illinois Governor Pat Quinn says Wisconsin should follow the lead of other Midwestern states and legalize gay marriage. Quinn said Saturday during a break at the National Governors Association meeting in Milwaukee that gay people should not have more rights in some states in the region and less in others. Gay marriage became legal this week in Minnesota. Quinn says he would sign a bill to legalize gay marriage in Illinois, but it's tied up in the legislature. He called on Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and the Republican-controlled legislature to follow the lead of those states. There is no movement to do that in Wisconsin, which banned gay marriage in a constitutional amendment passed in 2006. Kevin Hermaning, should Wisconsin legalize gay marriage, and do you think it will?
I don't think it will. I think that most people I know believe that citizens of all stripes on this particular issue should be respected. The privacy of their decisions, things that go on behind people's doors need to be understood and respected. Legal documents can be drafted to take care of a lot of the concerns that the gay community has in the state. I would also say that Governor Pat Quinn really ought to spend more time focusing on his own state and solving the fiscal woes of their budget process, as well as their big pension fiasco down there. Some of the things that the governor of Illinois says out loud just continue to amaze many people on the right and even in the middle.
Ed Falone, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that you're going to see a move to amend the state constitution in Wisconsin to remove the ban on gay marriage. I think that the wounds are still too fresh on that. But I think that it's unnecessary. I think that the Windsor decision by the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional has put in place sort of a slow-motion movement where over time, because we have, what is it, a dozen states now that recognize same-sex unions as marriages, I think that over time, states that don't perform same-sex marriage within their own borders are going to be forced to recognize and accord equal treatment to residents who were married elsewhere in a same-sex union that was lawful in the state where it was undertaken. And so over time, as a result of this Supreme Court decision, eventually you're going to see nationwide recognition of equality of rights based on same-sex unions. It won't happen very quickly, but it's already in motion and it's inevitable.
Senator Tammy Baldwin is leading a push to allow gay men to donate blood. Gay men have not been allowed to donate blood in the United States since the emergence of HIV and AIDS in the 1980s. The ban was instituted because gay men had higher rates of infection. The disease can be transmitted through sexual activity and blood transfusions. Baldwin, the first openly gay U.S. senator, and 84 other Democratic lawmakers sent a letter to Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, saying the ban fosters, quote, an atmosphere that promotes discrimination, end quote. Baldwin and other senators say donors should be screened based on health factors and not sexual orientation. Is she right, Ed Falone?
Well, I want to be really clear here on what my position is. I've long taken the position that medical and health decisions should be made based solely on scientific data and not on religious principles or political correctness or any other political consideration. I think that either the data supports sexual orientation as a risk factor for various communicable diseases that maybe hepatitis, it may be other, I don't know, but either the data supports sexual orientation as a risk factor or it doesn't. And if it does, then in health decisions such as being a blood donor, that should be the basis for the decision, the data. And I disagree with Senator Baldwin in this instance in interjecting other non-health considerations, such as equal protection or discrimination. I don't think that they should be part of the equation. If she believes that the data does not support sexual orientation as a risk factor, that's fine, and that should be examined definitely. But if it does support a link, then that should be the end of the story.
Kevin Hermaning?
Yeah, you know, this is an area where I agree with both the discussion, the description, and the characterization of the issue with Ed. I also believe that health issues are not those that should be decided upon by politicians. Science is very important. Clearly, politics plays a role in elevating certain issues to the forefront. Tammy Baldwin, as the nation's first U.S. The first gay U.S. senator, openly gay U.S. senator, feels compelled to raise this issue to the area of importance that she believes it should have, and I certainly can appreciate that. I don't agree with her politics and her policies, but nor her lifestyle, but that's not the issue here. The issue has a lot to do with who should be making public health decisions, and it certainly should not be political leaders. It should be people who have studied issues and have studied the data.
The Republican National Committee wants NBC and CNN to cancel upcoming programs about Hillary Rodham Clinton and is threatening to blackball the networks from future Republican presidential debates if they fail to comply. RNC Chairman Rince Priebus calls the program's political ads masquerading as unbiased productions. He vows not to partner with the networks on GOP debates if they don't pull the programs. Clinton has not yet said whether she'll run for president again in 2016. Kevin Hermaning, do you agree with Rince Priebus?
Well, I think Rince has a right to raise this issue. The bias that has been expressed for many years by the major networks, and as well as the cable channel, some of them, to prioritize Democratic philosophies and principles, and those who hold them, and ridicule those held by people on the right, the Republicans. It's a legitimate public debate that needs to be held. I guess if the liberals and the progressives can pressure media outlets to behave in a certain way, it is the right, and I think the responsibility of those on the right to do the same thing. I think he's doing it in the right manner. I think his donors are expecting it and demanding it. And we're not talking about the debates for the nomination process exclusively. I think we're also talking in general about the overall debates. I know how it's reported in the news, but let's face it. Republicans don't watch CNN and NBC for their debates anyway. People who want to watch Republican debates are going to turn on Fox or the networks that are going to be less biased in their reporting.
Ed Filone?
Well, I sometimes the level of hypocrisy that comes out of the GOP establishment astounds. Let's all remember that Citizens United, the case, opening up the floodgates for corporate contributions in political campaigns, arose out of a conservative-funded anti-Hillary documentary and the arguments about the right to free speech and the right to donate money to support that documentary and pay to have it played around the country. And here, all of a sudden, the GOP establishment has discovered that anything that might be pro-Hillary should be stopped dead in the tracks. I think that this is typical, Republican National Committee tactics, whine, put pressure, just keep whining, and hopefully you might get what you want. And that, unfortunately, is sometimes the Democrats give in and reward that behavior. And there's nothing that Rince would like more than to have the GOP primary debates scaled back or canceled altogether. I think there's a general perception within the GOP establishment that it was the abysmal performance of multiple candidates in multiple primary debates that really was the main factor in the reelection of President Obama. Less is more from their perspective. Hide the internal squabbling, hide the pandering to the far right, avoid primary debates within the GOP as much as possible.
Okay, well, we have to wrap it up, and it's time to reveal the answer of our Week in Review quiz. And congratulations to Mike in Mindoro for getting the right answer. What lab-grown food item did scientists introduce to the world this week? The answer, a burger. A 5-ounce burger was grown in vitro from cattle stem cells at a cost of $332,000. Well, that won't be showing up on the dollar menu anytime soon. Combined with salt, breadcrumbs, and egg powder, plus a little red beet juice. Said it tasted close to meat. So congratulations to Mike and Maduro. Thanks to Ed Filone and Kevin Hermaning for being here with me today. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing and directing, and for Christy Taylor for on-air production. I'm John Munson. Have a great weekend.